I might be.
Well, somebody foolishly asked, how big were the speakers? Okay, I think you can see on the back that 4x8 sheets of plywood give you the scale. One of the things is, if any of you ever hung speakers, you know you have to aim them down 15 degrees and off to the side 15 degrees and twist them 5 degrees. And the way we make sure that works, you can't quite see this real clearly, but there's a steel wedge in there that is cut on basically two angles in order to guarantee that we get the exact fit angle and it doesn't move. And so these aren't adjustable. In the old days, consultants would always say, give me this angle plus or minus 5 or 10 or 15 degrees. When you do that, that means you have to space the speakers farther apart, and we don't want to do that. We want the speakers absolutely as tight as possible touching because we want as minimum gap because we want to create as little interference as possible between them. And so that's why you get these kinds of clusters that are freaking large, pretty loud, handle a lot of power, and are built very solidly. So the question is, this is outside my shop in Pittsburgh. That's how we move speakers. We bring in a crane. They get crated, and he puts them on his truck. And one of the things you have to ship with the speakers is the rest of the mounting hardware.
That's the tube for one of the...
And that's what the truck looks like. That's got two speaker clusters on it, plus the mounting hardware.
How close to weight is it?
Oh, we're well underweight because we're only about 8 or 10,000 pounds. Because we really, we do try to design... Now, one of the things that isn't obvious is all of the steel tubing is filled with foam so it doesn't ring. Okay. There's a couple other tricks we do. And it's, for example, it's all at least 4 coats of paint, 2 coats of a rust preventative primer, 2 coats of finish coat, and then we cheat. We used to use an expensive paint that was very hard to match. Instead, we now final coat it with Rust-Oleum from the Home Depot so you can go pick up a matching spray can, and that way our color is standardized. Naturally, when we do the stadium... The first question we ask the architect is, what color should the speakers be? And because we're hanging these things while they're still putting up the steel, while the cranes are there, because we don't come in when they're doing the finish painting. So we finally said to the architects, your choice is black or white, and they picked black. After they were hung and they started painting, they said, oh, can we make them brown? And the answer is no. You can't just spray the speaker brown now because you're going to cover the front of it, and that probably would be bad. No, we're using commercial product. I've had a lot of input into how they're designed. And in fact, I know that at one of the meetings at JBL, when they were doing that, they mentioned that I had to build my own speakers for certain jobs, which is why they basically started making bigger stuff. They have a very long-term plan that they're almost finished with as to which size speakers they need to make and which techniques. And they're the ones who understand that how I want to be using a loudspeaker. One of the things I didn't mention is the Seahawks Stadium uses a different brand of speaker. And that brand treats the crossover as an equalizer, so that their speakers are much flatter in frequency response out of the box. So if you want to do a show and tell, they usually win the listening contest. But as some may have noticed, that when you play a full range music through them, they don't sound as good because the low frequencies are distorting into the mids into the highs, and that's the result you get of trying to build a full range loudspeaker or try to equalize it passively because the crossovers can't handle the power really when you're peaking it, so they measure well. The other thing is that particular manufacturer used to run... I wasn't going to say. That particular manufacturer used to have a 200-foot cable connecting their test amplifier to the speakers in their test chamber. So as a result, every loudspeaker essentially had a smile curve because the impedance rises at low frequencies and rises at high frequencies. And so as a result, they had more output, they had less output at lows and highs over the longer cable. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Are you using passive crossovers or is everything...
Everything we use on a big speaker is an electronic crossover.
Okay.
Okay. There are often protection components in there for the guy who hooks up the woofer to the tweeter. I did have a stadium job where the manufacturer shipped all of the speakers with the thing marked woofer going to the round compression driver and the thing marked tweeter going to this big paper cone product. We gave them a $250,000 warranty claim for sending people out to rewire it. They didn't understand how it could be so high, but you've seen the pictures of what the structure looks like on this stadium. You imagine going out to rewire every single speaker. And their question was, well, why don't you just rewire it at the amplifiers? Because we run different gauges of wires to the woofers and to the tweeters. And so they had to be rewired at the clusters. yes, they want to know why we didn't test all the speakers when we got them, and our question was, how did these get off your production line? You know, after we ship the speakers, then we start building the racks. And this is the back of a rack. We're very fond of sheet metal because we can build it in-house. As a result, every cable is basically tied into place. This reduces the amount of field modifications. Well, I didn't have enough patch cord, so I went to the back of the patch bay and moved some wires around kind of stuff. Undocumented changes and other errors like that are why sound systems get replaced, because they just don't work. They're not reliable. And as you start replacing them, you realize that wire going from A to B now goes through C, D, E, and F, and G before it gets back to B. And in room C, somebody turned off the power to the preamp. And as silly as it sounds, yes, that really does happen. I had somebody who redid one of my systems, and they wanted to know why we ran a speaker wire halfway around the stadium instead of put a DSP box in a nearby room and use that to run the amplifier. And the answer was very simple. That DSP brand requires a complete link, and if somebody turned out the lights in the closet, the whole sound system would crash from there on out. I didn't explain that. This is the front of the same rack. This basically has distribution amps. In the stadium, we have two methods of distribution. One is AES-3 directly to the amplifiers via fiber, and we had to build those boxes ourselves because that's not a commercial product. And then the other is a backup, which is a standard audio distribution amplifier, which is transformer isolated at the send and at the receive. One receive transformer will typically drive multiple amplifiers. Everybody else has all these weird things about you have to ground the racks, and you have to put in these ground buses and all that, or else you're going to have hum. We have no hum introduced because we basically send with a transformer, receive with a transformer. Any wiring inside a rack is wired balanced, but without transformer isolation. Between racks, it's mandatory for us to be balanced. So inside a rack, if we have an unbalanced, we're not too concerned. We will not wire unbalanced between two racks. We prefer to wire balanced between two racks, and between any two rooms, we must have a transformer. And so that's because the neutral in the U.S. has some voltage on it. And when you have two different rooms and your neutral is connected to your safety ground, that means that you have a voltage difference on your safety ground and your chassis and all your gear, and therefore we do not want that to go between the two rooms. We figure inside the same rack, they're all fed from the same safety ground, therefore they have all the same voltage on the case, which is why we have no problem running an unbalanced or a transformerless inside a rack or adjacent racks. Again, we can run just twisted pair. A standard twisted pair without a transformer will reject up to 6 volts of AC difference on your safety grounds. More than that, and the input op amps will saturate, and you'll hear a nice clean buzz. On between rooms, it's very easy to get more than 6 volts, which is why we always use transformers. A good audio transformer from Jensen in boxes of 100 is about $80. For our backup use, we use a triad transformer that runs us in quantities of like 250, of like $4 to $5 each. And measuring them on my audio precision, I see 0.1% third order harmonic distortion, and that's about it. So at the operating levels we use.
What's the
which one are you using? I think it's a TY-146. It's the biggest one they make. It's fairly cheap in quantity. Onesies are still $25. This is the front of the left control room rack, the top half of it. Here's the bottom half of it, sliding keyboard. I mean, you know, these are racks. I'm not sure how much you can say about a rack other than it's a rack. This is the side rack. This contains the wireless mic receivers, the announcer preamplifiers, which are vacuum tube. It's got a cassette deck and a CD player, and it's got a switch to go between the primary and the secondary ref mic. The ref mic, there's also one of the Yamaha Neve processors, which we actually don't use because the ref mics have AES output, so the ref mics, again, are synced off the same master clock as everything else and go into the mixing board. The one mistake I made was the CD player was originally going directly to the mixing board. And when they expanded the output of the mixing board, the Yamaha no longer had enough smarts to figure out to convert from 44.1 to 48. So we had to put in an inexpensive box to go from 44.1 to 48, which also took the clock. So we now stay fully synchronous on every single digital input. I'm not sure how many of you have ever had to design anything to do the reclocking on the AES standard, but there are some certain chips made. Basically, about 20 nanoseconds of clock jitter in a really tweak hi-fi system begins to show up. And so our clock jitter on the system, throughout the entire system, we stay under 4 nanoseconds. And that's distributed through fiber and everything else. And that seems to be, well, it's more than overkill for a stadium, but it was easy to achieve on the bench, so we might as well do it. Anybody else here ever run a big AES-3 system? I'll take that as a no. Or did I see a hand? Okay. This is the back of the same rack. This is, again, in our shop where we're testing it. The idea is that the whole side rack connects via two cables. One cable is analog audio. The other cable is digital audio. That way we have some isolation between the two. This is the mixing board, again, in the shop. A Yamaha CL1. Pretty standard digital mixer today. Almost easy to use.
I was there.
Yeah, I mean, you can get lost in a mixing board. The problem with modern digital mixers, quite simply, is you can bury something on a sub-level nobody else is ever going to find. And the other thing you have to make sure of is when you're doing the test is that you're going through an input channel that has no EQ. Sounds like a stupid thing, but you've really got to be careful. This is the back of it. As you can see, we break everything out. You know, to me, this is a pretty standard way to wire stuff. Other people I know will dress stuff a little bit tighter. I'm not as worried about that. Everything is labeled. You know, if you cable one goes to input one, just in case any of you don't understand that technical relationship.
I know people that don't.
Oh, there's a lot of people who get that one confused. And again, this is one of the things that kills the system. If somebody decides that they want, you know, input one going to fader seven, so they'll move the connector in the back of the board instead of moving it in the patch bay. And that's why it's okay to do it in the patch bay, not to do it inside the digital part of the mixer, because you'll really freak somebody out who has no clue. Okay. This is another stadium shot. I presume you've all seen enough stadium shots or whatever. I'm not sure there's anything magic about that one. This one I've already shown you. This is one of the smaller clusters, which is dead on. This is one of the larger clusters, which covers both seating by the field, seating in the end zone, and seating up in the nosebleed section. And that cluster is probably about, I think it's 18 feet long and about 9 feet tall. And that's one of the ones that weighs about 4,000 pounds. We use more than one bolt to hold it up, though, just in case anybody's not feeling comfortable.
Is that one of those that you were showing in the shipping
cables? Yeah. And as you can see, we ship them the same way. So literally, the crane picks it up out of there. We actually give them the bolt hole patterns to drill in the steel when they're fabricating the stadium. They lift it up. Their hole accuracy, our hole accuracy is enough that all they do is slip the bolts through and tighten them up. We every so often get somebody who asks, why don't you weld instead of bolting? And the answer is if you weld, you have to x-ray it to be sure that it's a good weld. Any of you who want to put a dental x-ray machine up there and sit in a chair doing that are welcome to try. I prefer to bolt it.
To fly.
Okay, another cluster.
How many clusters are there?
That's a good question. There's four big ones, and then there's probably 32 little ones or something. I forget the count. My guys who built them can tell you each and every one. You know, again, this is an under balcony speaker. It's a full range speaker, so as a result, it doesn't really match. And this is one of the aluminum bleachers empty. This will resonate at between 100 and 150 hertz. And even though there's a full crowd, it resonates long enough. I mean, when you hit it, it rings. It's a bell.
Yeah.
And as a result, that completely distorts the sound in the stadium, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with the sound system. But if somebody's sitting there looking at an analyzer trying to adjust the sound system for flat, they're going to screw it up something fierce. Okay? Because this is an acoustic problem. The architects, I used to have an article about how they claim they designed the stadium to be loud. I am unaware of them having any acoustics whatsoever into it. Again, here's the stadium where you can see the scale of things. You can see how that beautiful horn loads all the crossfield echo up into the nosebleed seats. And so those are the ones that are most critical. If I can get the speech intelligibility there, I have it everywhere.
So how did you solve that problem that all the bleachers are, you know, you don't solve that problem?
We have to not excite them, and we have to make sure that there's a crowd. And so in theory, we would need a variable tone control based upon the crowd level. We do have enough DSP presets we could actually do that, but in practice, I'm willing to accept that it gets muddy on the south side if they don't have a crowd. Because if they don't have a crowd, I don't really care that much. You know, I'm sorry, there are certain practical aspects to it. The expensive seats are not affected because they have the near-throw speakers or the under-balconies or the club seats. We did not do the actual suites. Somebody else did them, and I have no clue whether they're happy or not.
Expensive seats are also padded. They're not that.
Yeah.
But they're not the resonator.
Yeah. And we're, again, only talking on the one side, the south side.
Before you move from this slide, can you give us an idea of the distance involved from the...
Typically, that's about 150 feet from the deck to the ground.
And of the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 layers of people that we're seeing there, I think,
Yeah.
Are they all listening to that cluster, or there's clusters?
The cluster covers people. Okay, now I can use this.
Good.
Okay, the cluster on the far throw covers those folks. These folks, those speakers cover these folks. There's a forward and a rear firing to cover all of those.
Okay.
These folks are inside the club, and there are some under balcony speakers for that. And then these folks, again, have under balcony speakers, and I think you can see one right there. And then these three speakers cover those folks, and the reason why we need three is because there's a far throw, a medium throw, and this throw. And obviously, it's a different distance, so these speakers all have different power levels. Okay, but the timing is designed so that as you walk up and down, you can't tell when you change from one speaker to the other.
And what timing is involved in that?
What we do is we measure in between two speaker coverage zones, and we look at the time of arrivals, and we adjust them so that they coincide. Okay, if the cluster is properly assembled, the adjustment is less than 2 milliseconds worth of adjustment. And when we get down to very fine adjustments and things, rather than actually adjusting time delay, we'll put in a filter at a frequency below where the speaker works, which takes some processing time, which then can allow us to do phase alignment. Now, we haven't fully tuned this system yet, believe it or not, because in our contract, we tell them we want 1 week of quiet time to tune before opening, and the construction firm assures us we will have that.
Okay. Say so, what year?
Well,
you notice a lot of people cackled, right?
Yes. So once the stadium opened, the university is like, "Well, we have people in the offices now, so we don't want you making noise either." So, in between the team actually using the field as it was close to opening and whatever, we probably got in 3 to 5 hours of tuning, and I don't think we've had a total of 10 hours of tuning because we look, you know, we have to tune for level. We have to tune for time delay. We have to tune for frequency response. Then we want to start looking at phase response. And so I'd say we were almost finished with frequency response. We've got time in. We've got level in pretty close. We've got the frequency response pretty close. I think we probably have adjustments of less than plus or minus 1.5 or 2 dB trim on the frequency response. But I do want to check all the speakers a second time because when you've got, I think it's about 125 amplifiers, most of which are 2-channel, some are 4-channel, some are 8-channel. So we've got a whole lot of speakers in there. And so you really want to be sure that everyone really is set the way you think it is. And so most of my time, because I'm required to go to every game, is just walking through every zone. And if I hear something that doesn't sound right, then I have to go back. The other thing I do is I look at the crowd. And if the crowd is seated uniformly and they're all screaming at the same time, then they can hear. If I get a section where the people are moving out of there in the other seats or something, then I know I've got a problem zone. And so I can pretty much so look at it, and the only real problem I know is that they sell that section last, so if there's nobody sitting up there, I used to go up and listen, and the answer is no, it's fine. It's just those are the cheapest seats, and they sell them last.
So in time adjustment of the cluster up there, the three boxes pointing to that upper...
Right, those three point to this.
So those are adjusted.
Yes, those are adjusted, and then this one falls down, and all the other speakers in here have to be time adjusted. So when the sound from that hits here, or maybe this edge, those speakers are timed in to match that.
Okay.
Okay, yes, there's a lot of to do on making sure your time alignment is right.
Yeah.
So the reference is the big cluster at the top.
The one that's farthest away is the one that sets your time alignment in most cases. And there is some shift in the time alignment due to wind, due to temperature change, and due to humidity. Mm-hmm. Before we shipped the system, we looked up the average humidity in Seattle, and we did a frequency compensation for that built into the program we shipped it with. And that turned out to be pretty close. Actual frequency adjustments, we didn't need to do a whole lot of, because we know what the behavior of the speaker, we could do that. Where most folks spend all their time tweaking frequency response, that was probably the easiest part of this.
Do you do any time adjustment horizontally?
They asked about that, and the answer is we can't do that because of the way the speakers are wired. They're daisy-chained. Ordinarily, I would be able to do some of that, but the under-balcony speakers, because they're a budget item, they'll put like 4 on a circuit, and that's more width than I want to be doing a time increment on.
So those are all time zero, essentially.
Right, and the reason is that the guy who did the suites did them all in one circuit. And so once the suites are on one circuit, I can't do anything because the most cost-effective complaints as far as the management is concerned come from the suites because they're the folks who are spending money.
And they're not glass-enclosed.
They are glass-enclosed, and to make things really incredible, They're a roll-up garage door, so you can't put a ceiling speaker right above the opening.
Oh, my. So it's both open and closed.
Yeah.
Wow. So where do you put the, where did they put the speakers?
They put them back by the entrance, so the only sound that really goes into the suites is the overflow from the rest of the bolt.
So it's coming from behind the people sitting watching.
Right, and I think for the first game they put that on the radio announcer instead of on the game day. Hmm. And there's also some suites in the end zone that were not covered originally. And they ended up putting additional speakers in there after the first game. But that's back of house system, not my bailiwick, which is kind of annoying because people judge the overall whole system. Mm-hmm. The way to properly have done the suites would have been to put in-wall speakers in, but that would have required doing some additional carpentry because an in-wall speaker assumes there's a cavity behind it. When you've got two suites facing each other, you've got speaker to speaker, and that's not going to work. And so you need to make sure that, you know, the speakers don't hit the same cavity. So you've actually got to put a horizontal in, one upper, one lower, and do it that way. Yeah, there's a lot of bits of finesse to this.
And these speakers in the big cluster, are they all the same components per box? Or
no. The three rear firing, okay, one of them is has a different high-frequency horn for a different pattern, but other than that, they're very similar. Then this one is really two boxes, which is a mid-high box, which is a horn. That box is about 4 foot by 4 foot by 4 foot. Interestingly enough, because of the atmospheric absorption, you need your energy more on the tweeter than on the woofer in the mid-range coasts. And so that one's a big horn-loaded mid-range, so that speaker probably sees 5 or 10 watts maximum in use, where the woofers are seeing a kilowatt. It's really that dramatic, and the tweeters will probably be seeing 300 watts apiece. And, of course, there's typically two or three tweeters per woofer. And then the far-throw speakers, the side ones at the top, they're a JBL's VLA, which is a three-way speaker with, like, two 15s, a couple of 5s or 8s or something, and then some compression drivers, 8s. Yeah.
Convert the landed rate to slow version. So, if for some reason the upper level was empty, would you kill all of that?
No. No. It. Although in theory you could set up presets and you have individual control, because you have enough diffraction from the bleachers, I'm not going to worry about how much extra cross-field echo I'd get if that section was empty. And then the other problem you have is, if they actually have to block it off before we'd want to consider turning it off, because otherwise people will wander around. And if you have a discontinuity in the sound quality, you will generate complaints. The sound is uniform, which, like I said, within plus or minus two really throughout the whole bowl, then nobody complains.
But are those the bleachers, the aluminum bleachers up there that are resonating?
Yeah. That seat I showed you before is, actually, I think this is the north side, and so it's the south side that has that.
That looks like Lake Washington.
No, this is the south side.
That's Lake Washington.
Yeah, that's Lake Washington.
It's looking east.
Yeah. So, yeah, these are this is the new side. Yeah, I should see it because it's, yeah.
So you're generating all of this 150 hertz stuff by having the PA on if it's empty.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's...
But that's the lesser of two evils.
Well, in order to figure out which sections are empty, well, the good news is it's never that empty. Okay,
yeah.
But yes, if they really start playing the no crowds, then they'd have to start looking at closing seating sections and turning off speakers.
But they use this PA for soccer games and stuff, right?
I have no idea what else they plan to use it for.
I've heard PA going at night.
About that,
no, I'm thinking about this one because there's UW soccer or something. I've heard something. We go to the volleyball matches in Heck-Ed, which is over here, and at night I've heard something going on there, high school football?
Is
high school football championship?
They play for practice.
I think they're building a soccer stadium north of the IMA.
Yeah.
And so if they are using it now, it won't be very long, I don't think.
Oh. But there was something going on with a small crowd that you could hear yelling.
Yeah.
There's
Can I tell you what it was? Full of practice with the crowd noise.
No, it was... I think I read that it was a high school championship.
They have done one of those there.
Yeah.
But... there's very poor communications between the actual coaches, the folks who run the system, and the academic department management. Because the guy who's in charge of the system will get a call from the coaches saying it's not loud enough, and he'll get a call from the administration management saying it's too loud.
Right.
And so he gets nervous about that.
I think I read an article where somebody was had the coach said, here, listen to this, and played something from his office, which I guess would be here, played something during the day, during a weekday. Said, here, listen to this, and played us something through the...
They don't have that capability.
Okay. Maybe it's just the video then, because it was something.
Yeah, they can...
Well, there it goes.
It's back.
It's back.
So they have the coaches have no ability to talk from the thing.
They can use a wireless mic if they want to, but they require somebody there to operate the system.
Okay.
It's not an automatic system.
Okay.
They did ask about using the sound system to provide noise during practices.
Right.
And when I explained to them that that's fine, but they'd be taking life off the system and plan on spending $100,000 a year on replacing the speakers for the stuff you blow up doing that, I think they figured out it was better to blow up the system on the field. So they have a portable system that they blow up every other practice.
Your earlier volume map showed the intense volume in the stands and the crowd and not much on the field.
Right. That's where the ref mic is.
Yeah.
So we don't want much reinforcement on the field.
Right.
This may change. More and more teams are basing their sound system purchase decisions on what they hear at other stadiums. And it doesn't occur to them that what's on the field is completely different than what's in the stand.
Well, coaching. Also, if it's not on the field, you're getting less cross stuff because you're isolating it as much as possible.
Well, right. To a certain extent, but the field's fairly absorptive. Right. It's the cross field, when you look at that horn, it's reflecting it from one side to the other. I mean, you're really a matched horns.
Doesn't it depend on what the angle of the people? We're talking about speakers pointing.
Right, the speakers are pointing at the people. The people absorb sound, but whatever's left will bounce. Again, it's loading into the horn and will go to the other side.
Yeah.
That's why we need to see at least 15 dB. Empty, you're barely there. Full, with the people in, we're fine.
But if you wanted to amp the sound on the field for some reason.
Well, they actually put speakers on the edge of the field so that they can play louder on the field. And the problem is that I think their budget was $20,000 for those speakers, and they blow them up every single game.
Sweet.
Yeah. You know, it just that just doesn't buy you the kind of volume because, you know, we for the peak level during the game, they will play 102 as the team comes out. That's for, you know, 30 seconds.
There are clusters of 15-inch and a 2-inch horn with a single 18 at the bottom there, called the System 1. So
yeah.
System 1 system, the thing that is so powered with
Sounds like a market need to be filled. It sounds like a market need waiting to be filled to me.
Well, there's plenty of product that will do that. They did not choose wisely.
Ah.
Okay. And the other thing is they didn't spend money.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, $20,000 to cover 300 foot by however wide a foot.
To 105 dB?
Yeah.
Nowhere near enough.
Nice.
What was the JBL woofer that was used in the...
No clue what the model number is.
I mean, I presume it was fairly modern, not a D130 or...
No.
It's the
Lanaray
system.
Oh, yeah.
It's the Bristol version of the Vertec.
Well, this is actually VLA. It is a very modern woofer. It really will handle close to 1,000 watts. I don't know whether it's dual spider or not, because I haven't ever had to repair one. The dual voice coil is a little bit too new for they're doing the dual diaphragm compression driver, which is their newest one, which will probably go to my next project.
But I thought they debuted the dual voice coil in the VLA.
They could, but I really don't, you know. Like I said, I haven't blown one up yet, so I haven't had to repair it, so I don't know what's in there. There are some other speakers of theirs that I'm very familiar with the parts that are in there.
Why would that be?
Yes, the VRXs, I'm familiar with what's in them. They no longer, the standard glue that's always been used for loudspeakers is a rubber cement, specially made, I forget the name of it, but every loudspeaker manufacturer has used it up until now. Eminence now uses one that is closer to Elmer's glue, which is a modified polymer for theirs, because they're getting rid of the harmful vapors. And JBL's gone to one that's a variant of super glue, so now I'll have to buy a special Loctite adhesive that keeps in the refrigerator for up to a month. And you have a special prep spray and all the rest of this. And yes, you wear gloves when you use it because you really don't want to get any on your fingers. You know, that problem. So they've upped the glue so they can get more power handling. Boy, I can't think of the name. Okay, so let's go on to the next one.
Building plywood.
What?
Building plywood.
No. It's a Blacks Moyen. CP Moyen makes the glue. Every speaker manufacturer uses it. They just refer to it as Moyen. Okay, it's now up to $7 a tube, and a tube does about 1/15-inch woofer plus a little bit. So its price has gone up enough. Well, you can buy it in a quart for like $45. The problem with a quart is it always goes bad before I get around to using the whole thing, because we just don't blow up that many speakers. If you're blowing up a lot of speakers. Okay. This is, as I said, just the patch bay. You can see how many interconnections. This is a fairly logical flow patch bay. The top row are the outputs that feed, you know, the very top patch bay are the outputs. The very first row below it are the first 24 inputs to the mixing board. And there's a miniature patch bay you can see in there, which is the 96 point. That's for the AES patch bay. So one 96 point patch bay handles all the AES connections, and all the rest of the patch bays are for, the bottom ones are for distribution to like the different rooms. So if somebody wants to tie in the press room or something like that, that's distribution. The top section is mixing board, and the middle section is input buffer amps and all the rest of that kind of stuff. We try to lay it out logically. In theory, signal flows from top to bottom.
Are the amp rooms scattered around the building, or are they all in one spot?
There are four amp rooms, one in each quadrant.
Okay.
All on the same floor. They have ample air conditioning and ample power. They all actually followed my recommendations on that.
You have a picture of the amp rooms?
No. It's an amp rack. I mean,
can you see the heat coming out of the back?
No. In fact, one of the rooms, the air conditioning didn't work right, so they fixed it. So the rooms generally run about 60, 55 degrees. They're cold. Okay. The amplifiers are all modern switching power supplies and that, so they're fairly efficient, so you don't really generate much heat. We use Ashley amps.
Oh, really?
Okay, yes. Ashley makes amplifiers that are big enough, and they have all the DSP built in. Ashley did something very clever. An amplifier that is stereo in, its DSP feeds its own amp, and it has two stereo outs for feeding a slave amp. So all the subwoofer amps are just dumb amps, as cheap as can be, just plain watts for the dollar. And then the mid-range and high amps are all smart amps. They're all networkable. They all take AES in as the option we chose. And so we literally have our fiber boxes, send it downstairs, where it's turned back to copper. The copper plugs into the amplifiers, and then we have the backup through the analog system. Mm-hmm. I like the sound of the backup better, so we've just been running on the backup. At some point, I'll figure out why and fix it and go back to the digital. Pretty standard. There's an AM-FM tuner at the top, which, of course, doesn't work. The scoreboards are, I don't know, 500,000 watts of switched LEDs, and for some reason you just can't pick up an 8,000-watt AM station 5 miles away. I explained this to them early on when they said, well, we have to be able to feed AM. No, they now take an ISDN line via the telephone company from the station into the stadium to get radio. Okay. We did an arena, and the guys are, we want to play AM so that the people can bring their AM radios in. So we took an AM transmitter and put it in. And at the legal 100 milliwatts, it was good for 30 feet. I turned it up to 25 watts. It was a switching design. It was designed for use in this country or export, meaning that they knew you could turn it up to 25 watts. At 25 watts, I got almost 300 feet. Not enough to get from the catwalk to any of the seats.
Oh.
But at least, remember, the scoreboards are distributed in a stadium, so they're close to the seats. So you stand no chance whatsoever of using an AM radio inside a modern arena.
Was that where the RFI was coming from when we were tuning?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the scoreboards are horrible at that. So anyways, the thing marked mix is, in case the Yamaha mixer dies, there's a backup analog mixer. So if everything goes wrong, they can plug into that and they can mix the system. The problem is, in the old days, you had an analog mixer. An analog mixer, every circuit card is independent, and that's why you had spare power supplies. Because if the power supply blew up, the spare power supply would take over. Assuming you were smart enough to notice the primary power supply had failed and you weren't already on the secondary. Then when the secondary went out, then you were screwed. But that's a different issue. Because every card was in an analog mixer separate. Even if you lost your master output, you could come out on auxiliary output, you could do something else. With a digital board, everybody for some reason wants a backup power supply. I've got news for you. It is not the power supply that's going to go out in a digital board. If the software doesn't hang up and screw you, it's going to be you blow the one chip that is needed to process the signal. The other great failure mode in a digital board is what's known as a blathering idiot, and that is you get something that sends the wrong signal into one of the inputs, and the board keeps trying to lock onto it or figure out what it is and uses up all its computer power, and then it starts getting intermittent and sounds grungy. So there's a lot of interesting failure modes, none of which have to do with the spare power supply, but everybody still insists on having a spare power supply for the digital board because you always needed one for an analog board. So instead, we have a little 8-input or 6-input analog mixer, which is actually really all you need for a stadium because the announcer preamps are there. You basically need the announcer preamps, you need a feed from the video, and you need the ref mic. And so as weird as it may seem, that's actually enough to get them through a game. The control screen down below is actually used. We put it in so the back of house guys use it because they didn't bring their own computer. Well, actually, they brought their own computer. They didn't bring their own CRT and keyboard. And so the hole is where they put in their keyboard switch because they didn't know that you can tap a button on the keyboard to switch between it. So the guys who put it in would always have to stick their hand in there and hit the switch button. We finally showed them, see, hit this key. How do I know which key? Because it's the only one that doesn't have dust on it because it's the only one everybody keeps hitting. Okay, I'm sorry. It's very clear. You know, it's a construction environment. The key that doesn't have dust, try that one. Okay, it's the same thing with combination locks in the airport where they have got the 4-button keys. After the airport's been open for 6 months, you know what the combination is. Anyways, you don't need to use that. So I finally got that panel put back in last game. This, again, is the side panel. Down there is Fred's little Tarasandi because he likes to watch to see what frequency the feedback is coming in on when he gets feedback because he's a little cut above everybody else. Oh, there we go. Well, it's decided we're done with that display, I think. Let's see if the computer decides to actually give me anything. So nobody's here from Microsoft.
Or wants to admit it.
Okay, well, this is back to...
What is that little computer you're using?
This is a Microsoft Surface RT. Yeah, that really was the last slide, so we're done with this one. But anyways, Fred uses his little to see which frequency is ringing. It's a little bit overkill. It's designed to be a complete test system in a box. These days, of course, you can do it on a cell phone, so it doesn't really matter. Cell phones? Yeah. I haven't either, but I figure once you own one, you keep using it. I mean...
How did you arrive at the geometry for the cluster? It was a very unusual the way you had built the chassis.
That's done with the ease. You have the model of the stadium, and then you know where you can mount speakers, and you figure out what the angles need to be, and then, like I said, we machine those steel parts so those speakers are locked in.
Okay, so it's pretty much calculated.
Yeah.
However,
the important calculation issues are where you want it to cover and how much overlap you need to have. In order to know how much overlap, you need to know what the wind speed is going to be and a bunch of other conditions. And as far as I know, everybody else just today just says, okay, 5 degrees, because that's what Don Davis taught us. Actually, Don Davis taught you just touch them. Most folks went to the 5-degree overlap, understanding that just touching didn't work because your coverage pattern is frequency dependent. It varies with frequency. It's not perfect. And so if you just touch at 2K, you might miss at 500.
Okay. Is there any provision in this design for power disappearing and needing emergency announcements?
As a matter of fact, there is. Let's see if I can show it to you. The very top thing in that rack that says fire and page inserter or some such is a very magical box. If there is a fire announcement, it automatically cuts off both the AES feed and the analog feed and inserts the fire announcement. If the emergency power system comes on, all of the amplifiers will automatically be switched to that. However, we do not wish to use full power. And so that has a high-pass filter, because we high-pass filter about 150 hertz, we only require about 30 to 40% of the power. What everybody else does is they put just the mid-high amps on the emergency power and let the woofer amps go off. And I don't want to do that because, in some cases, it's the amplifier is doing more than one thing, and so, they're running into those kind of issues. The other problem is when you lose your woofer amp, you also change your coverage pattern on a lot of speakers because there's some overlap into the mid-range frequencies. And so by just tailoring my frequency response, I still maintain my coverage, but I drop my power. And so that box has more relays in it than you would believe, because you can take out any relay and it will still continue to function. So instead of using one relay for an A-B switch, there's four relays, so that there's A-B, A-B. So even if a relay welds, even if a relay opens, the box will continue to function.
So there's emergency power on in throughout the stadium.
Right. And so this is all on. This is all of this stuff is on the emergency generators. If the emergency generator kicks on, all of this stuff will continue to work.
Cool.
So what is the maximum electrical power into the loudspeakers?
We have easily 250,000 watts we can put into loudspeakers. I never bothered adding up all the totals, but it's in that range. I mean, the smallest amplifiers I think we have are 1,000 watts a channel. Now, we've got some small under balconies that are, I think, 250 watts a channel. But those are 8 channels in a package, so you're kind of, you know, rack space limited as to how much amplifier you can get.
Who do you use to sequence the power on for the amplifier section?
We don't sequence the power on. The amplifiers are part of the FirePage system, and so they do have they're very high efficiency, so they draw typically 20 watts when they're off, but they're still always on.
Oh, sure.
Okay. And I think at this point, we'll give up on that.
You did East models. Did you do SDI calcs and SDIPA or?
STI, okay. I was hearing it was SDI for a second. Screw that. Yes. The EASE models' STI numbers are not complete nonsense, but they're not fully accurate.
Well, yes, I've spent a lot of time with those numbers.
I have my own method of calculating what STI will be. I've been working with STI since the early 90s. I built my own STI meter back in the early 90s. I offered it at one point to see if anybody wanted to commercially build it, and they figured that it wasn't possible to sell commercially because it had over 3,000 parts in it and used like 2% capacitors, 1% resistors, because it was entirely analog. It was based on the original STI system. And so, yes, I understand what it takes to maintain a good STI. We never had a chance to fully measure the STI in the stadium, so instead I sent the guys to measure the absolute worst spots, which is where you're between speakers and the farthest throw. And our lowest STI number, I think, was a 0.59.
Did you use a signal and then use an STI meter?
So yeah, I have all that here.
Can you talk about STI?
Speech Transmission Index. It's Hoot-Hotz and Steenikens' method of measuring the modulation transfer function we discussed earlier. And so they measure the modulation transfer function on an octave. They have octave band carriers, and then they have, again, octave band modulations at a much lower frequency. The STIPA, I think, is 32 of those points, which are then averaged to give you a reading from 0 to 1.
And to make it more confusing, the fire codes say STIPA, and there are two weighting scales, male and female, and the fire codes do not specify which one you have to do.
Well, the fire codes are going with CIS. They'll also accept STI. I forget what the appendix is, but it's not mandatory. It's only a supplemental appendix.
Yeah, yeah.
And
they're still not clear, even in the supplementary stuff.
Right. No, it's not clear. It's pretty good, though. If you're measuring your STI, because when you're talking about male or female, you're usually talking about speech recognition. You're right. The fire code does allow you to do the standard speech recognition test, which is where you say things like, please write the word chalk now. Please write the word Coke now. The actual STI test just says, please write the word Coke. I throw in now because it was originally developed for doing telephones where you didn't have masking, and so if you leave the word at the end of the sentence because the reverb falls off, you can still make out that sentence in the echo. And that's why I put the word now at the end to make sure there's still masking after it. And so that test, you're right, if you do it with male and female speakers, you do get different results.
No, but STIPA in EASE has male and female, two different weighting
curves. Right, but that's trying to convert STI to alcons.
Yeah.
And alcons is one of those things that Don Davis championed that I see no validity to whatsoever.
Yeah.
Don Davis's theory was you look at the articulation loss of consonants because you almost never lose vowels. And in my measurements, that's not true either. And so when you do an actual articulation test, which is like I just said, where you read the list of words, there's 50 words are phonetically balanced to represent all the phonemes. And I've got recordings of that. That's the way we really used to do it, because when somebody said, well, people are complaining they can't understand, you'd put on the test disc, you'd let the people walk around and realize they really could understand all of it, and then they'd either have a chat with the announcer or replace the announcer. The announcer is usually the reason why systems are inconsistent. So if you can understand it one day and can't the other day, it's because the announcer was using this microphone, and the next day they gave him a different microphone, and today he's excited and talking, and then sometimes he talks like this because he's reading something over here. And that's why I point to Fraser's a great announcer. His colleague does a good job. And I've seen some really horrible announcers, guys who literally cannot talk into a microphone to save their lives. Any other questions?
The gauge wire, you see?
That's an interesting question. Under some interpretations of the National Electoral Code, if you run 8-gauge wire, it is assumed that you are running a high-power circuit, and therefore it must be in conduit. So our thickest wire is 10-gauge. However, if you understand skin effect, once you get into the mid-range and the treble speakers, your 10-gauge wire, the center isn't even being used, so we run 14-gauge for anything else. So woofers are 10-gauge, mids and tweeters are 14-gauge. And 14-gauge is about 30% the cost of 10-gauge.
What kind of distances?
I don't think we have more than about a 500-foot run for our longest speaker run. You know, I don't think we have less than a 200-foot run.
All unbroken runs or no
non-splice? Of course, we do not believe in splices.
Were you involved in the RF antenna for the ref mic referee?
As a matter of fact, I was. Originally, they wanted the Sennheiser wireless system. We gave them the Sennheiser wireless antenna. Somebody else decided they would put an antenna farm on a bar outside the window. So we put our antennas there, and they worked fine for the test, and then people went and put their transmitters up, and, of course, the antenna stopped working. So we gave them helical antennas that we build in-house, and they're very happy with those. And they aim them, and eventually they'll get around to actually mounting them instead of leaving them on mic stands. And the other thing is we use, I think it's RG213 for the cable going from the antennas, because that's another thing that's hard to explain to people, is your loss through your coax is greater than if you move your antennas 5 feet closer to your receiver. You laugh, but by the time you go through a couple of, you know, you're traveling 300 feet from the field, and the guy wants to move his antennas 10 feet closer and has two more connectors. And it's like, no, you really don't understand. I don't mind if you put it inside the room. I don't mind it going through the glass. It took a long time to convince them of this. And so now their transmitters are on one bar, and their receivers are somewhere else, but they're still not back to putting them up on the ceiling where I wanted to put them. Yeah, there's RF is one of those things that in the past we used to do all the in-house cable television. And the high point of this was after I did Heinz Field, AT&T took over and they put up these big signs, we wired this place for cable, let us do your house. And of course, they didn't wire the place for cable. They actually took it over from the previous cable company, and their guy gave me a bad cable feed. For those of you who have never done RF, is you can push RF through a cable. You cannot suck it. And so the guy put the feed into the basement, took it upstairs to the control room, and then put the amplifier on to get the right level, which gave him a noisy, grainy, horrible-looking signal. As soon as it changed from AT&T to Warner, the guys looked at this and said, this is stupid, put it downstairs where it belonged, change it to a fiber feed, and the image looks much better, but they no longer claim to have wired the building. Okay. Although last year they did upgrade to the IPTV system, which means every TV set is now wired on Cat5, and so there's a 10 to 15 second delay between what goes into the TV signal and what actually shows up. But now they have the theory of being able to sell hot dogs over the TVs in the suites.
And you say you put the helical antennas in the window. What window?
There's a window over in the,
audio control room?
The audio control room's at the 50-yard line high on the south side. And there's a glass window that doesn't open. And so they literally put two mic stands and aim them like this, aiming down cross field. Actually, they're aiming more like that. Mm-hmm. And the helical antennas have, I think it's a 13-inch diameter back disc out of aluminum. They're 12 inches long, 6 inches plastic tube diameter with a wound helical copper element. And then there's a little tuning stub inside. Yeah, I mean, we build them in-house. I think Shure is now selling one like it for about $400 or $500. They're finally now affordable. They're about $75 to build if you have all the parts. Of course, you also have to the tuning equipment and all the rest. Yeah, I have a machine shop, I have a metal shop, I have a wood shop, I have a paint shop, I have an electronics bench, I've got all those gears because I've been doing this for 40 years. I have everything excepting a tablet that projects well.
So what was this about interconnects?
What do you mean?
Interconnects, measuring interconnects.
We could bring that article up. One of the things I did was I wanted to know if the lead-free solders really sound the same as the leaded solders. So I built a test instrument that JJ has seen. And what I do is I create, it's about 90 and 93 kilohertz tone, and I apply it at 15 millivolts, and I made up a little strip with 200 solder joints on it on a PC card, and I put the signal in, and then I look across it to see what I get out. And if I get anything at 3 kilohertz, that's a distortion product, which means the solder is creating distortion. And trying like half a dozen different solders, the cheapest stuff I could find from Radio Shack, the best stuff, the thing I learned was lead-free solder requires a higher temperature, does not flow as well, does not form as pretty a solder joint. And if it makes any difference at all, the amount of distortion it produces is less than the distortion of having built the instrument in a steel case. It turns out that the steel case does create distortion that I can see very clearly on the instrument. Now, while I had it, I decided I would check audio cables to see if I could see a difference between them. And the answer is the difference between audio cables is greater than the difference between solder joints. And much to my surprise, when I plugged the audio cable in this way, I got a different distortion pattern when I plugged it in that way. And I repeated this a number of times, so I wrote the article for Audio Express saying, here's how you build the instrument. And by the way, here's some of the results. And there's a number of people who didn't understand it. You want to build the instrument, it's a fairly simple test. You want to run about 15 millivolts. You do need to build a really clean power supply to power it. I run it off batteries. I run it off four batteries because the receive section is two batteries, the send section is two batteries. I've since done articles on measuring resistor distortion, so you have to use the proper low distortion resistors and all the rest of this. You have to use the proper low noise op-amp. The LM4562, which was National's big push audio op-amps, is the one I used, which I learned you have to use a small coil in front of it because otherwise it picks up RF and saturates. The AD797 would be the other choice, which is probably a better choice, but I know that today, not back when I built it. So the answer is audio cables are directional. One of the theories was it's caused by microdiodes being formed in the copper. So I took a copper strip and I hooked it up and I took a torch. I measured it, took a torch, heated it up till I had lots of copper oxide on it, even melted off a small piece of it. When it cooled down, I went back to measuring the same. So my conclusion is it is not microdiodes. It is not impurities in the copper. I have no clue why. But it's consistent, repeatable, and easily observable. And for JJ, when he came out, I showed it to him. I reversed it. I showed him the difference. And I put it back the first way, and you got the first pattern again. So it's a consistent, repeatable result.
How far down is it?
I was going to say, what JJ likes to point out is, oh, it's like minus 160 dB.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking levels that... You have to understand, you know, on my FF...
for 5 minutes.
Yeah, on my audio precision, it runs for 5 minutes doing enough averages to get you that far down in the dirt. But the phenomena exists, which I thought was somewhat interesting. I also can measure distortion resistors. That's another article I did that appeared in Linear Audio where I do a standard Wheatstone bridge. But I do four resistors series parallel here and four resistors here. And since they're all identical, since the four have half the voltage, they therefore have a quarter of the distortion. And so you see your distortion magnified. And it turns out that, I know you're going to find this hard to believe, but carbon composition resistors have the highest distortion. And in fact, one of the audiophiles one time listed all his favorite carbon comps, and he listed, starting as his favorite, the one with the highest distortion. He came down to the midpoint and said, there's Kiwami and Ohmite, and they sound almost the same, but I prefer the Kiwami. And when I first measured Kiwami and Ohmite, I thought that Ohmite was importing the Kiwami, so I noticed there was a tad difference in one of the harmonics of the Kiwami. Then you get to the carbon film resistors, which have much lower distortion. Then you get to the metal film resistors, which have much lower distortion. But it turns out that if you're using like a 10K quarter watt carbon film resistor in the feedback of a power amplifier, if you've got a good power amplifier, the feedback resistor at full power is probably producing more distortion than the rest of the amplifier. Because it has a thermal temperature coefficient. As you heat it up and cool it during the cycle, it creates distortion. And so there is the $15 naked Vishay resistor that all the audiophiles love. And that achieves its zero temperature coefficient through some mechanical stresses, and those show up at low frequencies as being a problem. And the Dale Brown, technically known as Shit Brown resistors, if any of you have seen them, are the best cheapies. They're like 37 cents a piece and measure the best, but the really big black Dale Military and the blue IRCs, the half watt resistor is the size of everybody else's 3 watt resistor, are indeed the best resistors that I've ever measured. The naked Vishays have, I think it's more third, and the Dales have more second. Temperature coefficient shows up as third harmonic distortion. What used to be called voltage coefficient, and some folks still call it, shows up as second harmonic. Because when you measure resistor, you understand that if it heats and cools, and it's nonlinear with temperature, you're going to get some distortion. The There were other people who noticed that as you applied the voltage across a resistor, with more voltage, resistance would change slightly. They called that voltage coefficient. That actually is caused by microdiodes in the resistor matrix, and the better the purity, the better it is. I did give copies of my articles to a couple of resistor manufacturers, and they haven't said a word, but I gather that the resistors are now much better. The cheap Chinese resistors Mauser cells are better than the cheap Chinese resistor DigiKey cells. You know, so if you want to spend a penny a piece, you buy the Mauser resistors. So it was really kind of interesting, but yes, you can actually measure the distortion in a resistor using a standard laptop computer with a sound card. Okay.
So was there any conversation about the how perceptual that was?
Yeah, that was my question. Can you hear it?
Well, that's just it. The guy who rated carbon composition resistors got them exactly correct from the worst distorting to the best, and he preferred the worst distorting. He absolutely ranked them correctly.
Or so, consistently.
Yes.
With the distortion.
Yes.
But just in an inverse
right.
way.
He preferred the sound, the distortion that the carbon composition's resistor produced.
Does it add more character?
Yeah. As it'll have a little bit more loudness for the same amount of power. Because the spectrum's a little bit wider.
Yep.
So like you said, I think it's the same reason people like the singlet and triode. As you get toward distortion, the signal bandwidth broadens a lot. It sounds louder. Sounds like it has more dynamic range.
It does. It's louder.
It's louder, but it's not more powerful. You've got to be careful with those two words.
Oh. What noise? Okay. In actuality, there's a couple of other noise sources. One is thermal noise. Thermal noise theory is related just to temperature. What I do see in the carbon compositions is base spreading. I put in a 1 kHz fundamental, and I try and that mostly gets notched out. But you'll see that there's a lot of base spreading around it, which tells me that when the resistor is seeing power, it's creating 1, 2, and other low-frequency noise. So it is generating self-noise as the voltage is applied. The theory is that there's inner carbon granule arcing and other stuff, which I have little trouble believing, but it's very clear that anything that is a granular-type resistor does indeed have increased noise with applied voltage. Does that answer what you were asking?
It answers a different question, but that's all right.
Okay. You want to talk about 1 over F noise? No, I didn't measure that. Sorry, should I tell you about what I got when I measured capacitors?
Sure. Yeah, why not? There's magic capacitors too, right?
Well, actually, it turns out the magic is in the direction in which you mount your capacitor. The definition of capacitance is C times V equals Q, or the capacitance times the voltage is equal to the charge. A little bit of calculus gives you the C dV dt plus V dC dt equals dQ dt, which equals I, most of which is nonsense. People understand the capacitance times the change in voltage over the change in time affects the current. What most people ignore is the change in capacitance times the voltage also affects the current. Because everybody says, why do capacitors change? Because capacitors are made out of layers of plastic and metal, and when you whack them, the two move, and therefore you get a change in the capacitance. Well, how much whacking does it take? Turns out there's a base vibration level, even in a concrete building, of about 5 mG. And so if you put about 10 volts across a capacitor, some capacitors will give you up to 1 mV of noise. Others will be down in the microvolt level. And so whenever you have a capacitor, it makes noise whenever it has a DC voltage across it. The second problem with capacitors is even if you have a perfect capacitor and you put it in series with an audio signal, the measured harmonic distortion will increase. And the reason for this is very simple. The capacitor is a high-pass filter, and even if you set it very, very low, it attenuates the fundamental by a small amount, and it attenuates the harmonics by a small amount, but it's less than the fundamental. Therefore, your THD ratio will increase whenever you pass a signal through a capacitor. And so if you figure that your capacitor should have bandpass down to 20 hertz and set your 3 dB point for 20 hertz, you're going to see your measured THD increases dramatically down around 20 hertz because you dropped the fundamental in half and effectively didn't attack the harmonics, so your harmonic distortion appears to double. Okay, so the two issues with capacitors are you need to isolate them from vibration. Well, what's the easiest way to do that? There are wound capacitors And since vibration generally goes from the earth from this way, if you have a wild capacitor, mount it vertically so that the plates don't see any force on them. There are stacked film capacitors, which are stacked this way, so if you mount them that way, you've got a problem. If you mount them vertically, you don't. So most of the capacitor problems can be avoided by mounting them properly. The other issue are electrolytic capacitors. It turns out the bigger the case size for the electrolytic, the more mass and the less sensitive they are to vibration. So when you can buy the miniature electrolytics with the same rating as the larger one will create less self-noise or less vibration-induced noise. Yeah, once you start playing with all this stuff, you can measure absolutely incredibly small amounts. I also measured PC cards. People have told you if you resolder all the joints in your stereo, it'll sound better. Well, I just told you solder joints don't matter. However, what does matter is if you solder the through-plated holes, they will sound much better because through-plated holes measure enormous amounts of distortion for as small as they are. And so just filling all those holes with solder will indeed improve the performance of your gear. And I built an amplifier card, and I measured it, and I dropped the distortion probably in half by using a bad PC layout and then filling the through-plated holes. Any other tweak questions? You know, folks have said it's complete nonsense, and turns out you can actually measure. It's like, you know.
The filling part, of course, is how far down.
Oh, well, the distortion is real. You can see down. You don't have to worry about it. You know, on the resistors, yes, resistors actually have enough distortion.
Yeah.
If you're using a carbon comp resistor, that will show up in the audible range, particularly when you realize, as we were showing you the Fletcher-Munson curves, when you've got some 20 hertz music, we're not talking off a recording, but actual music, that's going to be modulating that carbon comp, and you're going to be seeing harmonics all the way out there. And that brings up the next point, which is, what harmonics do you hear? Lots of measurements. Dr. Bose used to believe you can't hear less than 1% distortion, because there's good research that shows that second harmonic distortion is very hard to hear 1%. But I'm not worried about second harmonic. Music has maximum energy around 150 hertz. Your ear is most sensitive at 3,000 to 6,000 hertz. So let's look at 20th harmonic distortion. Okay, you can literally have in music, because you roll off at 3 dB per octave, you can have 50 dB more noise or more signal at 150 hertz. Why are you giving me the funny look? You agree with that?
It's the whole point is that, you know, 1% of second harmonic distortion is probably inaudible. I mean, it's going to be, even at the worst case, it's going to be very close to mass.
Right.
If you look at, oh, say, the 20th harmonic of a 100 hertz signal, if you have the same 1% distortion there, you're going to hear a 2 kilohertz tone going.
Yeah, it's
going
to be horrible.
Plain as day.
But
so, you know, what distortion are we talking about
here? So here's what becomes important, is because you have so much more energy on the low frequency end. If your recorder has 0.1% distortion, and your microphone probably has 1% distortion, and you go into your media, which let's assume it's perfect. It's a CD. CDs are perfect, as we all know. Then we're going to go into a D to A converter. Well, it turns out in a CD player, the mechanical improvements you make to a CD player actually do show up as making the CD sound better, not because they reduce the error rate. The error rate coming off a CD is almost infinitesimal, but because the D to A converter in a CD player usually shares the same power supply as the analog section. Anytime the motor is grunging and groaning, that shows up in the audio output. So your CD player is going to add another 0.5% of distortion or something. Then you get into your preamp, which is another 0.1%. Then you get into your power amp. And before you know it, you've got 20th harmonic distortion, maybe at 40 or 50 dB down or 60 dB down from where you expect it to be. But your signal level is so disproportionate
You know, one of the classic things that finds that is just playing the beginning of Dark Side of the Moon. You notice your boom, boom, and you listen to some systems, you hear.
But yes, if you want a high-end CD player, all you need to do is take the optical output and run it to some other D to A converter and run them off separate power supplies.
Or you solder a couple of great big capacitors in a few places.
No, that's not good enough.
It improves things.
Yes, I'm currently working on an article on power supplies.
I'm not talking about power supplies. I've found a couple of them don't have the reference input for the CD. Is just a resistive divider off the power supply. There is no filtering. There's a word for this, but I don't think I'm supposed to use it in public.
In a typical CD player, the problem really is that they are sharing a common power supply.
Yeah.
But any power supply, if you go look at your power transformers, you'll see they're all rated for 110 volts. every single one. And the answer is we don't run 110 volts, but they're capable of working on 110 volts. However, they saturate. And if you hook up a power transformer to a power line, properly working, you'll see third harmonic distortion coming out of the transformer. You'll see every odd order harmonic coming out. And if you look back on the power line, they're injecting it backwards too in your house. Then you put on your rectifier, which creates all the second order harmonic distortion. Furthermore, if you look at the curve, it's a beautiful 6 dB per octave slope downward, where for you guys it'll be that way. And if you look at your Fletcher-Munsonyer sensitivity, it's a 6 dB upward. And so the noise that you would, you know, really don't hear at 120 hertz, your ear is going to be just as sensitive to that noise at 2 or 3 kilohertz, even though it's another 50 dB down, because your ear is 50 dB more sensitive. And so it turns out that if you get like an IC regulator, a lot of people look, gee, they work well up to about 3 to 6K, where their internal op amps are so slow they stop regulating, and it's really just the output filter capacitor on that's giving you all your filtering. And so the power supplies I'm looking at are really very simple. You take a dual-winding transformer, and each winding feeds its own bridge. That way you're guaranteed to be drawing equal current from each one. If one of them has the top coil phase, so this is in phase, on the other one, you do it to the bottom. Then when you combine the two, any common mode noise coming through is canceled. And that's a great way to build a power amplifier power supply because you have no additional loss. If you're going to do a mic preamp or something, then I run that into first a Mylar or other film capacitor, which then goes through a very small resistor to my next set of capacitors. It turns out that a 4,700 microfarad axial capacitor starts failing around 6 kilohertz. The internal inductance is high enough that the capacitance stops acting as a capacitor and becomes a resonator. Yeah. So I use radial capacitors, typically no bigger than 1,000 microfarads, and parallel five of them to another resistor. And after a time, I've got three chains. I see my noise level is down to basically the same as when I short my probe. Then I can run into a regulator. Jensen shows in their literature how to build a mic preamp using an 8797 op amp. The op amp has 80, 90, 100 dB of power supply rejection ratio at audio frequencies. It may drop to 60. However, Jensen shows it with uneven input impedances, so that the common mode rejection ratio, or the input, goes to almost to zero. Well, if you have any hum on your power supply, that's effectively the same as swinging grounds, that the mic preamp design that Jensen shows you is totally non-practical. Maybe it's a Jensen transformer to step it up, but if you take standard power supply, run it to a bridge rectifier, run it to, say, 10,000 microfarads capacitance, run it into a standard, you know, LM whatever regulator, plus and minus, run that into this Jensen circuit, you're going to hear the hum. It's just that bad power supply rejection ratio. And a standard, you know, simple power supply, like you see in most boards and whatever gear, really doesn't get out the noise. And so there are better transformers. There are the R-cores that the Chinese like to use because they apparently are making them faster than anybody else. Yes, if you have a Faraday shield inside, the foil shield, one of the questions is which side do you connect it to? Do you connect it to the chassis or do you connect it to the AC power line? The correct answer is you connect it to the safety ground on the AC power line, because even though the line cord is long and it won't effectively filter you at RF, the fact that you've got a copper foil shield there means that any magnetic field is reflected back to its source. So it's not grounding the shield that matters, it's just having the shield there. Next issue is power transformers are wound with a coil around a core. Big revelation. Your neutral wire should be going to the winding that's closest to the core, because your neutral wire has the least voltage potential difference between it and ground. If you actually wire the hot wire to the closest to the core, you'll typically see 2 to 3 times as much current drain going right into the core, raising your hum level. So when there are people who tell you if you pull out your two-prong plug on your CD player and turn it over and push it back in, it improves the mid-range, they're actually right, because that's getting rid of all those higher-order harmonics that, even though, you know, it should be getting rid of the 120 hertz, it's the higher-order harmonics that couple so well from the power line because your transformer is saturating. And so you actually can clean up an audio system by flipping around a couple of plugs. Low level, but we're talking minus 60 at this point, not minus 180, minus 120. So I'm finishing up this article on power supplies. I pretty much so know all what goes into it. I think Audio Express is going to charge people extra money to sell to them as a separate booklet instead of putting it in as an article, because it's already way too long. I thought that would be a 1 month article. I spent 2 years on it. If you guys want to go, I've been keeping you way too late.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes.
It'd be really great to listen to you today.